Yeah, thank you very much. I've been asked to talk about tabletop experiments with Haldar called neutrons, and it's really a tabletop experiment. Here's the table, and on top are ultra-cold neutrons. They are bouncing on this table and falling in the gravity potential of the Earth, and when they come close to the surface, we need quantum mechanics to describe the results, and this is what you see here, neutrons in different quantum states, in lower states, in higher states. And in orange, the probability to find the neutron on that table. The more orange, the higher the possibility to find the neutron. So in state 11, the neutron is mostly here, also here, 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 but not in between. In the past, we developed, it's called gravity resonance spectroscopy technique to carefully measure these energy levels, and this allows us to search for hypothetical gravity-like interactions. If they were there, they would change the energy levels and also the probability to find our neutron here on the table. And recently, we were interested in the nature of gravitation, so many effective field theories, they are based on theories which are not based on Riemann geometry or extension like Einstein-Cartan, or might have a non-geometrical origin. Or gravity might an entropic force, as suggested by Eric Verlinde. But this experiment here immediately was used as a counter argument against, because an entropic force is very noisy and it would destroy coherence. So we would not see a superposition of different quantum states. So, well, let's start and let's talk about properties of the neutron. There might be, and I hope there are no misunderstanding. Some properties are quite obvious. In the morning, when you're on the weighing scale, the scale tells you your weight in kilograms, and for the speaker, it's 36 kilograms protons and 34 kilograms neutrons. When you are then at breakfast, yeah, and eating the apple, and the apple is becoming yourself, then the electrons, yeah, here we don't care. That's just a few grams. Here, the fact 50% neutrons, 50% protons is due to the fact that on Earth we have this ratio, but this is quite exceptional. Everywhere else, except for planets, we have a ratio of 14% neutrons and 86% protons. And 1 second after the Big Bang, it was 17 to 83. And then neutron decay changed this ratio to that number. I think that's well known. You can read that in the famous book of Weinberg, The First 3 Minutes. And I'm just mentioning this to state that neutrons are abundant. We should not have a statistical problem with our experiments, but it's quite difficult to get neutrons out of the nuclei. Yeah, the size of the neutron, von Fermi, we had that on the first day. It's quite a consistent picture. Atoms have a size of 10 to the 10 meters. Inside is the nucleus made out of protons and neutrons. And with the scattering experiment, we can measure the size, the Rosenbluth formula. And with deep inelastic scattering, we learn that inside are point size quarks. So we have the size of the neutron with shear size of the neutron d is equal to 10 to minus 15 meters, but we have already heard that this is problematic because this corresponds to a neutron dipole moment. If we take this picture I've just shown seriously enough, of 10 to minus 13 electron centimeter, but the limit is 10 to minus 26, which corresponds to a size of the neutron of 10 to minus 30 meters. Yeah, this is close to the Planck scale, but we can do experiments at the Planck scale with neutrons, but not with the mass. It's then when the coupling is in the exponent, then we are lucky. So what is true about these numbers here? I just want to tell again that when we work with simplified pictures, then we might have a problem. That we believe in this side has also something to do that the Compton wavelength of the neutron H over MC, this is the wavelength of a photon which has the energy of the rest mass of the neutron, is also here 10 to minus 15 meters, but we are doing quantum mechanic experiments, and there's the Compton wavelength. The de Broglie wavelength in addition to the Compton wavelength. And this is velocity dependent. It's now h divided by, here is the velocity, and for, I can write it down here, for thermal neutrons with a velocity of 2,000 meters per second, this is 1.8 angstrom. So we are back in the league of atoms, and that's why neutron sources are built everywhere in the world to study materials, to tell us what's inside the structure and the dynamics. So this is the wave property of the neutron here, 2 angstroms. For ultra-cold neutrons, we are using here, it's 80 nanometers for a velocity of, let's say, 5 meters per second. Next, we have a coherence length for neutrons. Lambda, coherence, and what's that length? Well, we can measure, and now I have to find here the pointer again. We can measure it with a neutron interferometer when we split a neutron into two parts and bring it together again with the two detectors, A and B, and the coherence length is now the length when we use a phase shifter and shift these two beams apart from each other, the length when this interference pattern disappears. And that's again more than 2 orders of magnitude more. What can be measured is here a coherence length of 200 angstrom. So we are getting larger and larger, but this is a longitudinal coherence length. What's transversal? Well, yes, please.
What determines the 500 angstrom?
This is a measurement. It has been measured. It depends a bit on the preparation of the experiment. And for typical neutron interference experiments, it's that number here on the length. And now I would like to talk about the transversal part. And here an experiment has been done. Neutron has sent through this box with a distance of a slit of 33 microns. Yes,
so,
please?
So going back, so this is along the motion?
Yes, this was in this direction here. Yeah, you change one path against each other. Here, this is a phase shifter. You shift one part against each other. And after a length of 500 angstroms, this interference pattern disappears.
I see. Thank you.
So you have this also with the laser beam, with an interference Mach-Zehnder interferometer. Yeah, the length, the arm you change, this is a measure of the coherence length.
This is shorter than the de Broglie wavelength? Because the wavelength of that I observe this interference pattern over, are you just saying that these things are coherent for about a de Broglie wavelength? That's
they
where
are
the
coherent
scaling
on
is supposed
that,
to come
on
from?
That length scale, yeah, in the longitudinal direction.
That's roughly the same as the de Broglie wavelength.
The de Broglie, this is 2 angstrom, and this is 500 angstrom. This is a few orders of magnitude more.
Oh, so this is when you're running at But when you're running at 2200 meter per second.
I mean,
like you're not doing this experiment at 5 meters per second.
And this is coherence.
I guess I'm just asking, what is the velocity that you're talking about when you're talking about that coherence length?
This is here the velocity of 2200 meters per second.
Okay, thank you.
And the same neutrons are now transversing such a slit. And the slit size is 33 microns. And now you can guess what's the energy change of the neutron when the neutron is going through that slit. It's easy quantum mechanics. It's particle in a box. Yeah, you have walls here. And well, we can write down the formula. The energy for quantum mechanics particle in a box is 1 over 2m h bar, then this is an integer, divided by the slit size squared, okay? And now what's the answer? Mass is 10 to minus 27. So we can write it down the 4. This is 10 to minus 34 squared. A is 33 squared, 100. And 10 to minus 6 squared is 10 to minus 12. So this gives 1/4 or 0.2 pico electron volts. Yeah, when neutrons go through this slit, it's a quantum mechanical break. They lose energy, and you can measure it with, again, with a neutron interferometer. When neutrons, you have these channels where the neutrons have to go through. You move them in one path, in the other part, and you compare the interference pattern. So, and later I will show that we can transport neutrons in quantum states over a distance of about 1 meter. So we have all these length scales in our system. Maybe this we should take not too seriously, but from 10 to minus 15 to about 1 meter. So now I think we can start with our system. We have a simple gravitationally interacting quantum system made out of a neutron and out of a mirror, and it's reflecting on that surface.
Okay, but yes? just to go back to the previous questions, because I'm not convinced it seems
Which
to me
one?
Like you're mixing up certain fundamental things, like you know the Broglie wavelength or the Compton wavelength, those are
yes?
Fundamental quantum mechanics things, with the coherence length, which may have to do with how you prepare the neutrons.
I mean, yes, of course.
You can have photons that come out of a laser that has, you know, many kilometers coherence length, and it's the same kind of photon that if you make a stupid flash with a light bulb, they have a stupid coherence length.
You're completely right. It depends how you prepare your system. Yeah, it depends
so
on the momentum.
One is a practical thing, and the other one is a fundamental thing.
Pardon?
One is a fundamental issue, the other one is
of course,
practical.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Okay.
And now the next question is, why is the neutron here reflected on that surface? Yeah, so this is, neutron is neutral. The mirror is non-magnetic, so the neutrons just, they see the nuclei. So the nucleus potential is 50 mega electron volts at a distance of 10 to minus 10 meters. Yeah, and now with some hand waving arguments, yeah, the neutron is coming, yeah, with a long coherence and it's averaging over all these nuclei. So we have 50 mega electron volts, then the size of the nuclei 10 to minus 15 over 10. To the 10, here the distance of the atoms to the power of 3 gives the order of 50 nanoelectron volts. This is material dependent. Yeah, it depends also on the substance. So 50 nanometers to 100 nanometer. This is a potential step. And when the neutron energy is below this step of 100 nanoelectron volts, they are reflected. This is our neutron reflector made out of ordinary glass. So the neutrons are below that, and they are reflected. For that experiments, we have to go to the ILL, the most intense ultra-cold neutron source, where the neutrons are produced by fission processes. Here's the core. Fission neutrons have 2 mega electron volts. Nobody can make use of these neutrons. That's why there's a heavy water tank around. They thermalize. You just need 3 collisions, then they have the energy of 25 millielectron volts. So this is the spectrum of thermal neutrons. Yeah, velocity, the most probable velocity is 2,200 meters per second. And many experiments need colder neutrons. That's why we have a cold source next to it. Yeah, this is 60 megawatts. This is at 20 Kelvin. This is quite an effort. And neutrons entering the cold source, they are shifted here to the left. Cold neutrons have a most probable velocity of 800 meters per second. Unfortunately, we have no ultra-cold neutron sources at ILL, so we just extract the neutrons on this lower part of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Please.
You don't lose any neutrons.
This is probability versus velocity. So this is the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for thermal neutrons. The most probable velocity is 2,200 meters per second. This is the number I've used here for the de Broglie wavelength.
Yes.
And cold neutrons are shifted here to the left.
So you don't lose any neutrons going from thermal to cold.
Well, the neutrons which enter the cold source, then they get this velocity distribution. And then they're neutron guides where the neutrons are distributed to different experiments at ILL.
I'm asking whether if you integrate the distribution to get the total number of neutrons that you have, the density, you don't lose any neutrons when you cool them down a bit.
Well, there's some absorption, in principle, this is a heavy water tank you have here. And the cold source is a deuteron source at the boiling point at 20 Kelvin.
What would it take to get all of them ultra cold?
I mean, 20 Kelvin is not ultra cold. Yeah, the distribution is that one should use materials which is colder than that. Yeah, but then neutrons are reflected. Yeah, they are not cooled again, so that's a hassle. So this is not possible to make much better ultra-cold neutron sources. There are some tricks, and in the world, people are building new neutron sources, and there's the promise to increase the density sooner or later by about 3 orders of magnitude.
Oh, wow, okay. Thank
you. Okay, so these are the ultra-cold neutrons with this potential 100 nanoelectron volts, and for the gravity experiment, we use neutrons which have the direction against gravity of 2 picoelectron volts. Okay, so now we put our neutrons on the table, and we now solve quantum mechanically here the Schrödinger equation. The neutrons are free to move to left and right, but they're restricted in the c direction. And now it's convenient to introduce a scaling factor. So 6 microns, where the mass of the neutrons enters h bar and the acceleration of the Earth, and an energy with 0.6 picoelectron volts. And now with a change of variable, you arrive at Airy's differential equation, where the solutions are Airy AI and Airy BI. I'm not sure whether you are aware of Airy and why he has used these differential equations. Do you know? He had not quantum mechanics in mind, at that time. Who knows? Why? What was Airy doing?
Resolution of telescope. I mean, usually there's the Airy disk.
Yeah, there's this Airy disk. Yeah, and related to that, he had in mind, and we are here in Canada, so I think I can show this picture, yeah, of the rainbow. It's from the Canadian Post Office 2015. Very nice rainbow, here the lower part and the second one. And we physicists, we think we understand the rainbow since the book of Descartes, the L'Arc-en-Ciel, where he described a light beam which is then refracted and deflected in the rain droplet before it reaches the eye of the observer. Yeah, so for the lower and for the higher part, there you have two reflections, there you have three. Descartes has no idea where the colors came from, and we need Newton with the photon to explain that. But Airy was interested in these plane waves entering here a rain droplet, and these waves are distorted. And what Airy did, he integrated all these phase differences before they came into the observer's eye. And the outcome is the Airy function here. It's like a sine wave with an exponential decay where it's classically not allowed. This is for our neutron later on. Yeah, I need this part here. In quadrature, that's the intensity. So, and yeah, what Airy found out is that he was able to explain this interference pattern you can see here. It's reddish, and then again red, and red, and so on. If you were lucky and the rain droplets had the same size, yeah, you would observe here long interference patterns. Yeah, sometimes you are lucky and you can see some of this interference. So, yeah, if I make it a bit larger with this Airy function, yeah, when the sun were monochromatic, yeah, you would still see these stripes due to these Airy functions. So back to the neutron and this solution. Here, again, interesting is this part here. Okay, Airy AI in red, which decays exponentially to zero, and BI, which goes to infinity. And interesting is this turning point from convex to concave. Here, this point corresponds to the height, a classical particle, to the turning point of a classical particle which has the energy of that quantum state. This specific quantum state, which is given by the zeros of this function here. So here's the zero, this is the ground state. Yeah, the ground state has this turning point. The height is 16 micrometers. The second wave function, it's a bit higher. Yeah, this has this same turning point. That the turning points and that the energy levels are given by the zeros, this is quite, it's simple to see. Yeah? On the mirror, the wave function has to vanish 100 nanometers compared to pico electron volts. So this is infinity. Yeah. So if you like, you can apply a small correction, but practically our wave function is zero here. So so Airy AI is zero for C equals zero. So this is 2.38 for the ground state and 4.8 for the second state. So you have to use this number multiply here with this energy scale, and you arrive for the ground state here at 1.41 pico electron volts, 2.46 for the second state, and so on. Yeah. So this is the size of the neutron. It's just from the zero, this part shifted and sketched by natural constants, the mass and the acceleration of the Earth. And if you take the square, it gives the probability to find the neutron on that table. Okay? Now we can put a neutron into a superposition of these states, 1 and 2, 1 and 3. Yeah, and then the phase factor is becoming important because the phase factor here rules the interference between these states. And you can easily put a neutron here into superposition when you have here the neutron in the ground state, and when it's then falling down a step of, let's say, 40 microns, this is now here immediately an infinite number of quantum states. So what you see here is the interference, so that this is going up and down, it's vanishing, and out of nothing, it's coming back again. It's the interference of these quantum states. Yeah, and this is here the quantum bouncing ball. It you can see it in this picture. When the mirror is here, then we have this potential in the ground state for a neutron over there. This potential, the neutron is here. Now when the neutron moves to this step, then here there's nothing, but then this probability. It's a bit of a problematic picture to say, okay, the neutron is now at this step, just remove the potential, then our neutron here is not in an energy eigenstate anymore. We are lucky. Airy functions are a complete set of functions. So any function which is square integrable above our mirror can be written as a sum of an infinite number of Airy functions. So we can do that and describe our wave function here. So here's the mirror, then there's nothing, and then there's the wave function with an infinite number of states. And now it depends on the accuracy we have in our experiments. If you just take 30 states, yeah, then on a logarithmic scale, you can see it, but you cannot read it, but this is 10 to minus 4. Yeah? With 30 states, yeah, it's sufficient to describe the results on the 10 to minus 4 level. With 100 states, you have 10 to minus 7, and with 1,000 states, 10 to minus 9. We need a tool to put a neutron in the ground state. So we have here a state selector, which is made out of a mirror and a mirror on top. And this mirror on top does two things. First, it forces these higher states to have another zero here. Yeah, you can see it undisturbed. And now with the mirror, this is again here zero. And with the particle in the box, yeah, when you have walls and you move the walls together, then the energy goes up. This is what you see here for the second state. And the third state, the ground state going to zero in. Yeah, it does not feel this mirror on top. Now, if we make this second mirror pretty rough with a surface roughness of a micron and neutrons go through that slit, yeah, higher states, those here, they are scattered out of the system, and at the end, we have just the ground state. This is our state selector for this experiment. So we put neutrons through that slit, and now it's a trade-off between statistics and systematics. We have made this slit in such a way that we have 70% of the neutrons in the ground state and 30% in the second state. Then, and that at different positions, we have made snapshots of this neutron wave function. Yes, please.
So just back up a little bit. I'm trying to understand. When we shoot a neutron beam and it reflects off the mirror, right? I'm guessing because we have a velocity distribution, so it is like kind of in a superposition of different energy eigenstates. And what we're looking at is these eigenstates' evolution under gravitational potential. Is that correct?
Yes, but we do one step after the other, not all together.
Right.
So we have our neutrons on that table, and that's a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for these energies, which are very low. Yeah, they are all equally distributed. So we have the neutrons in the ground state, in the first state, second state, third state, and so on. And when they when these neutrons move in this direction, yeah, with a certain velocity, and allowed is everything up to, let's say, 10 or 15 meters, then higher states are scattered out of the system, and just the ground state and a bit of the second state is transmitted.
And experimentally, how do you control the initial quantum state when you before even this going on?
Yeah, we just by chance. So we just take a neutron beam. They go from left to right through this slit. Then higher states are scattered out of it, yeah, and just the ground state remains in the system.
Oh, okay.
And this is now moving, yeah, and now we make snapshots. Now this is in a superposition of these other states, and we make snapshots with a spatial resolution detector.
That's very cool. Thank you.
Okay, and these are the measurements, yeah. So the measurement at the beginning, then the neutron is going down. There's the lower turning point. This is the center of gravity for this system in blue. Then at the upper turning point, another measurement. So it nicely agrees. Then it goes down, and then another measurement. That this is not going to zero here, this has to do with the fact that the spatial resolution detectors, they have a finite energy resolution of about 2 microns. Yeah? So these are measurements. The neutrons are detected. They are neutral. So we have to convert the neutron into charged particles by a nuclear reaction. If we are just counting neutrons, so we use some kind of Geiger-Müller counter filled with helium. Helium-3 plus neutron is converted in triton and proton. We can count it. Or for these spatial resolution detectors, we have a piece of plastic called CR39 covered with boron, and neutron and boron 10 is converted to lithium and alpha. Alpha, one of these two particles, it's producing a track in the plastic. We remove the boron layer, we etch it, and with machine learning, it's quite easy to find out where the neutron is in the direction. Here on this piece of plastic, every point is a neutron. That's background. This is the slit when we have this detector right at the exit. Projected to the right gives us our probability to find it as a function of Z. And yeah, it's, as I said, 30% ground state and 30% in the second state. This is the state selector we use in our experiment. Yeah, so this is with the combined fit to these data points, we can here measure this the scaling factor C0. When we use a step of 20 microns, then this oscillation is here very pronounced. And with quantum mechanics, there's always a surprise. When we do this with a higher resolution, you can observe two things. Yeah? One thing is that here in blue, that's our quantum bounds, and in white, this is a classical particle which is falling from the same height. And what you can see here at the beginning, they are just in phase, and after a certain period of time, you can't tell whether the neutron is going up and down. People call that collapse of the wave function. And after a certain period of time, there are revivals, but they are out of phase. Yeah, the classical and the quantum phase, they are out of phase. We have to wait a bit. Yeah, it's starting here again to go up and down, and then you see they are out of phase. Yeah, this is well known for a certain period of time, but what we also observed, and this was some surprise, yeah, I just told you that the neutron is going exponentially to zero, yeah. That after 25 microns, there's nothing, but you see more here, yeah. And yeah, you have a question, please.
Just what exactly is the blue plotting here? Is that the expectation value?
Pardon?
What exactly is the blue curve here? Is that the expectation value?
The blue, this is the expectation value for the quantum mechanical system here.
So why does that, like, I would have thought that something like Ehrenfest's
theorem. I mean, you just average over this distribution here.
I understand.
And what I want to show here is that two things, that they are out of phase here, the classical and the quantum part, and that the neutron is in a higher, on this higher level as well.
So why doesn't something like Ehrenfest's theorem apply here?
Why? I can't.
Why does Ehrenfest's theorem not apply here? Like, I would have expected that the expectation value.
Yes,
of the wave
Ehrenfest is still in place. Yep. It depends a bit on how you define your system. What is the classical analog of it? Yeah, and it's not as easy to just to say this is one massive site at a certain height. Yeah, there's a mass distribution, and I will come back to that just in 5 minutes. When I show this picture here, you see it's a logarithmic scale, and the neutron is it's going all the way up here to 250 microns mm-hmm. with the probability. This is a contribution of 10 to minus 3. First, we thought that this is some numeric fault, yeah, and when we do the calculation with 100 states, yeah, we it's not an infinite number, yeah. What might happen, yeah, when you do that with more states? So we did the calculation with 1 million states; it's still there, and you can also calculate that million and higher, then they are not occupied in such a way that they can interfere with that to make it disappear. So we think it's real, and I've showed this picture to Wolfgang Schleich in Ulm, and he told me, oh, that's quite obvious. This is some scattering. You can do this in WKB approximation. It's a scattering of the wave function at this kink at the beginning. Yeah, and if this were true, yeah, there is maybe a classical analog. Yes, you have three spheres, and when they are falling down, yeah, so yeah, you can shoot it up to much higher parts. Yeah, okay, but this is a classical system, and this is described by Newton, where we can describe it in Einstein's words with two equations. One is for the gravitational field and how it's influenced by matter, and the other one is the response of the matter to this field. And with the interpretation of Einstein, you cannot disentangle of a gravitational field from free-falling frames when you do free-fall experiments, the reinterpretation of the weak equivalence principle. And yes, just this month, the final result from microscope came out. So the weak equivalence principle is tested on the 3 × 10⁻⁵ level. Yeah, that's incredible, but it's always performed on two different falling objects here, titanium and platinum. In our case, it's a quantum test of the equivalence principle based on a single neutron as an object where we have no classical path. In our system, we have two masses, yeah, the inertial mass and the gravitational mass. So two unknown, we need two observables. So one we have already determined, this is C0. The other one is the energy, and energy measurements can be done with resonance spectroscopy techniques. So what is resonance spectroscopy? Yeah, we all know that two-level system, and we need a coupling. The NMR techniques use magnetic moments in a magnetic field, which is then responsible for the Zeeman splitting, and radio frequency fields drive transitions. It has been invented by Rabi and made perfect by Ramsey, and we heard talks about clocks. It's related to the spin echo technique, and it is also used to measure the electric dipole moments of electrons or neutrons. Our system is slightly different, but pretty much related. It's a multi-level system, all these states, we have a coupling by vibrating the mirror underneath. Yes, this, by vibrating with the right frequency, we drive transitions, and we call this gravity resonance spectroscopy in analogy to the NMR technique. Gravity is doing the job for us. It's doing the splitting, and the mirror drives the transition. And this is, it's completely dark. No lasers, no coupling to an electromagnetic potential or field. So we have on hand now such a system. Yeah, it's quite nice. Yeah, we can prepare our neutron in the ground state, and these transitions we have performed when we put the mirror on top, so we can tune these energy levels when the surface is rough. It's our state selector, so it's we can address these states. Yeah. We can put the neutron in the ground state. We have these transitions. We tune the energy levels. And when we put the neutron into a superposition of quantum states, then the phase factor is becoming important. It allows us to search here for, say, space-time and cosmology effects. Simply, with a neutron, we have access to the gravity parameters here. But that's not the important part. The important is that the polarizability is extremely small. So we can probe for extra forces close to a surface. Yeah, with atoms, they stick. They are van der Waals forces. Atom at a distance of 1 micrometer, and you need tricks that they reflect. And at a distance of 1 micron, the energy change is 0.6 picoelectron volts. Yeah, that's a 100% effect. For neutrons, it's absent. Yeah, we can go many orders of magnitude. So our neutron, it might then couple to, for example, to scalar fields if there's a coupling, and it allows to constrain on any possible new interactions at the level of sensitivity. Examples are here. Hypothetical gravity-like forces like dark matter or dark energy fields. Immediately with a search for chameleon fields, we improved limits by 5 orders of magnitude. The starting point was the axion. The axion has also a spin mass coupling, so it might couple. So the spin of the neutron might couple to the mass of the table underneath, and the distance is a few microns, yeah, exactly in the range of this axion potential. And so we had also best limits with this axion search. It's quite simple because it's just a relative measurement. You polarize your neutrons when they are pointing up, yeah, and if they were an axion field, it would shift the resonance curve to the left, yeah, and if the field points down, it would shift it to the right. And with 3 days of beam time, we get these exclusion curves. So this is a spin coupling, dark energy. Heard a lot of about scalar fields. A scalar field might mimic a cosmological constant, because here the cosmological constant goes with the metric, and the point is always, if we had this coupling, then it would destroy gravity effects on Earth. So we need some exclusion, and so some screening. And for symmetrons, this was invented by Curie et al. This symmetron, it's related to the Higgs mechanism. There's a phase transition symmetry breaking in material and outside, so that you still preserve the gravity force on Earth, but it would couple to the neutron. We have 3 parameters, a distance, a mass, and lambda, this is it's how fast this potential goes, this Higgs potential goes to infinity, and we have here exclusion plots, three parameters. I can display only two, mass versus range, or lambda versus mass. And this was known before, excluded here and here. So we filled most of the parameter space so that some people say that neutrons here rule out a summatron's dark energy, and it's completely here in the dark. These are examples. It works because these extra fields, they would here add an additional potential to the gravity potential. So it's for this axion exchange, it's an axion potential, and axion, it's a dark matter field. For the summatron, it's a dark energy field. But at the beginning, I mentioned I also want to talk about an entropic force, and that's a different story, an entropic force challenges the fact that gravity goes into the direction of the gradient of the gravity field. Instead, entropic force is going to maximize entropy, and Verlinde has derived entropic gravity by just three equations, by assuming what is true for black holes. So when you place a mass close to the horizon where the distance is the Compton wavelength, again here for the neutron it's 10 to minus 15 meters, so that would change the entropy and is responsible to an entropic force. And now with three equations. The first one is a relationship between temperature and acceleration. It's related to the Unruh effect, but Verlinde states that at the end he does not need this equation. The second one is about entropy and information. So the units do not fit, so he's adding natural constants, just as Planck did that before, and then you need that energy is equally distributed here on a sphere, and then you get back the gravity potential. The problem is that such an entropic force that to describe gravity, it can be considered to do measurements. It's constantly testing where this particle is. Yeah, and this introduces decoherence. So these entropic forces, they are too noisy and would then destroy quantum coherence. And such a coherence is not observed in cold neutron experiments. Thus, entropic gravity cannot be true. Yeah, this is here our resonance curves. But then here, Wunder has suggested and described it here, this open system with the Lindblad equation where the dissipation comes in here. So this is our scaling factor. I've called that before Z. And sigma is a coupling. And what this coupling does, it's changing the coherence in our system. So these are our measurements, and depending on this sigma, it's changing the coherence. These are all the measurement points, but here this parameter in the limit sigma going to infinity, the model recovers Newtonian gravity as a potential force. So this experiment cannot be used as an argument against an entropic force. So then, again here beyond Riemann gravity. So I said before effective field theories describe gravity with non-Riemann parts, and so this is a proposal by Kostoletsky and Lee. So they expanded the Hamiltonian in Riemann gravity and beyond Riemann gravity in next to leading orders, and they have written down an Hamiltonian. So this is, so NR is non-relativistic, and you can see it affects here the free fall or the spin of the neutron. So, and you can observe these effects now in neutron interferometry. For example, when you tilt a neutron interferometer, so that there is a potential difference between the lower path and the different path, and this would introduce then a phase shift, and this is something you can observe. So you can derive limits on these parameters. For us, it would change the energy levels as well, and because we don't observe that here, the limits are about one orders of magnitude better than that. Lorentz violation, it can arise that when you treat Lorentz violating coefficients as dynamical fields, and then they acquire non-zero vacuum expectation values. What you see here, these are these expectation values with some fluctuations, which again give some changes in the Hamiltonian. And this has been written down by these persons here. And Andrei Ivanov has calculated energy shifts for our system, and we arrive at these levels here, limits for these Lorentz violation terms. So these are some examples what we can do with such a system on the table. The question is, how far can we get? There are high precision experiments with neutrons, with atoms, with molecules, and when we just get to that list, we see that energy changes can be measured on the 10 to minus 21 electron volt scale in the search for the electric dipole moment of the neutron. This is a small number. Yeah, it's 21 zeros and then the one. But the electron volt is also a small unit. Yeah, it's 10 to minus 19. So that's really tiny. We with our neutrons are here. Yeah, with 2 times 10 to minus 15 with the Rabi technique, the results I've shown are derived from an energy sensitivity of 2 times 10 to minus 15 electron volts. The point is that we are using the same ultra-cold neutrons. So in principle, we should get these limits over there. Yeah, so an improvement by 6 orders of magnitude should be possible. This is Rabi, this is Ramsey. Yeah, it's a higher sensitivity. And we started to implement Ramsey in our system. And so we immediately gained at least 2 orders of magnitude. So this is the sensitivity where we are right now at 10 to minus 16 electron volts. And we can compare this with the most precise atom EDM experiments. From the thorium oxide electric dipole moment can be restricted to 10 to minus 29 electron volts centimeter. This is much better than what we have for the neutron, yeah, this number over there. But there is a strong enhancement factor due to electric fields. On the energy scale, we are just a factor of 25 away. So we are not that bad, yeah? So with our spectroscopy, so the most precise thorium oxide experiment. I just learned from Peter Fierlinger that the xenon experiment is also working, and it's somewhere in between here between 10 to minus 18 and 10 to minus 21. So this Ramsey spectroscopy, how does it work? And it has been done at ILL in 2021, when I was unable to enter the ILL. So no disturbance from outside. And they managed to get this experiment running. Yeah, this is a great achievement. It's a Ramsey setup. You need five regions. First, this is our state selector, I have explained at the beginning. Then an oscillating mirror, stage one, where you put the neutron into the superposed position between two states. 1 to 6 is working pretty well. Then there's a time of flight, and there's another oscillating mirror. When they are in phase, yeah, so then you put them in state 6, and then the neutron cannot go through the state selector. There's a counter at the end. And on resonance, you see a deep decrease in count rate here. It's going down. When you vibrate anti-parallel, so put the neutron back to the ground state and it's transmitted, so the count rate is high. And with that, you can eliminate most of the systematic effects. So the neutron velocity range is between 4 and 11 meters per second. The potential, I mentioned it, the mirror potential is 100 nanoelectron volts. The length here is 1 meter. The distance between the mirrors, 30 microns. The step height here, it's the accuracy, it's about 100 nanoelectron volts. And yeah, statistics is low. The count rate is 20 millicounts per second. The alignment relative to G is 10 microradians. Yeah, and this is it's the superposition between 1 and 6, and that this is working, you see at this Ramsey resonance curve. So yeah, this is what has been measured in 2020 and 21, the resonance 1 to 6, and he also observed 2 to 7 here. I said 30% of the neutrons are in state 3. That's why the contrast is lower, but you can observe this effect here. So this is the most precise curve we have achieved right now. Yeah, systematic effects are small, so these effects are included. We do not have a sensitivity right now for velocity dependent effects. Coriolis and Sagnac effects are small. There are tidal forces we don't see. We are at the 10 to minus 4 level. It's here 10 to minus 6. We are using a rubidium clock to drive these mirrors, so they agree on the 10 to minus 10 level, and our sensitivity is here on the 10 to minus 6 level. So to improve, we want to store our neutrons. Now the observation time is 70 milliseconds. We are restricted by the lifetime of the neutron of about a quarter of an hour, 15 minutes. And René Sitmek is designing here a device where you can store a neutron here in centrifugal states. So then it would be quantized in this direction and also in that direction. Okay, so this is the Q-Bounds collaboration, TU Wien, Grenoble. So the Tulane University was involved in this entropic gravity and support from Nagoya University and Munich and Heidelberg. Yeah, thank you for your attention.
Hello. I'm still trying to understand this question about Ehrenfest's theorem. So could you just explain more slowly why my usual expectation, especially like away from the wall? Like I get that maybe when it's bouncing off the mirror, there's something funny, but away from the wall, I would kind of expect that the expectation value always follows parabolic trajectories. But in the movie that you were showing, that wasn't true. Why?
The Ehrenfest is, it's not questioned by these experiments. That you see this difference, this depends on how you display these results. You can come up with different situation how the classical particles are following, and you arrive at the same picture what you have here.
But even in the different, like with the three ball example that you were showing, I can have that kind of substructure in the classical particles. That's fine, but the center of mass motion of that system still follows a parabola. Is my question making sense? Maybe there's just some misunderstanding and I can talk afterwards.
It's about the expectation value here, but it depends on how you display your results. It's not a violation of Ehrenfest here. You just it's following this expectation value when you display it in that way.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, how far are you from measuring a force, a new force between the neutron and the table of 1 times gravity at, 6 microns?
Okay, so the question behind is whether we are able to measure the gravity constant. Yeah, so when you move a mass very close to this system, and when we arrive at this sensitivity, with 10 to minus 21, we could measure in principle on 4 to 5 digits. So this would be sufficient at the moment, but when we are here, we don't know whether this is still an important question. So the sensitivity is on the 10 to minus 18 level when you place 1 kilogram of mass close to our experiment. At the moment, we are 10 to minus 16, so we are about 2 orders of magnitude away.
But connecting to Sava's question, but the gravity that the neutron is sensing is the entire thickness of your plate or your table or this disk or whatever, right? So doesn't that mean that it's essentially all dominated by the stuff that is far away because there's more of it?
No, these gradient forces, a mass of 1 kilogram or 20 tons of gold underneath, so this is still far away off. To change it on the 10 to minus 4 level, this is not possible by gradient forces.
I mean, I'll just comment on the same topic, right? So actually, on Thursday and Friday, I'll show the plots. But I think the answer to Savas's question for short-range forces with micron length scales, these neutron experiments are something like 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10, the strength of gravity, for the mass that's within, let's say, 10 microns of where the neutron is.
Yes, that's why we are sensitive to these hypothetical gravity-like interactions, and these forces can be strong, 8 orders, 10 orders of magnitude larger than gravity.
Yeah, another
and
way to say
so
it is
these,
gravity
these
is so
axion
weak.
Forces, these symmetron forces, and then on that level, we can exclude these forces.
That's good. More questions? Then let's think.